This is Dave Willingham. I'm sitting here with Congressman Rick Larson. Thank you for sitting with us, Rick.
It's a pleasure to be here on 102.3, my first venture here.
And we very, very much appreciate it in this, you know, summer muggy day in our little warm box here. You wanted to come and talk to us some about your Youth Access to American Jobs Act that you've brought up again this session.
Yeah, there's quite a bit going on in Congress that I don't know that folks are paying attention to because there's all this other noise going on about the president and so on. But the job and the work of Congress continues. And one of those main issues that I'm especially interested in is how we train young folks for that next generation workforce. I think that Congress can give a better deal to American workers and to the next generation workforce. I think that a better deal means better skills for young folks. So I have this bill, the Youth Access to American Jobs Act. What I'm trying to do with this bill is to give states the opportunity to experiment with connecting high school students to apprenticeships and then those apprenticeships to real jobs through the community college system. Now, we do apprenticeships in this country pretty well when it comes to the trades. We don't do apprenticeships very well when it comes to future high-demand jobs, say in healthcare or in high tech. We need to give states the ability to experiment, to do some pilot projects with apprenticeships in order to, in my view, to prepare for an economy that continues to change, continues to be buffeted by global trends, and put our workers in a place in the future where we can continue to compete.
So in a lot of high-tech spaces, we don't have many traditions at all, but we don't have much of a tradition of apprenticeship now. And you're trying to kind of create that pipeline?
Yeah, I am trying to create that pipeline, and not just in high-tech, but in other higher demand fields that our Department of Labor, our Bureau of Labor Statistics, our own state has identified as jobs, high-demand jobs in the future. So what this bill will do is create a 2-2-2 program where you identify, give kids who are the junior and seniors in high school some opportunity to start thinking about apprenticeships. You get them into 2 years in community college, and then you get them 2 years into an internship. I think that there is a lot of opportunity in the United States to use this as one more tool to prepare that next generation workforce. Again, we need to give our workers of today and tomorrow a better deal, and doing a better job at preparing them with better skills in the future is an important part of that. And my bill, the Youth Access to American Jobs Act, is designed to do just that.
And so, like you mentioned, this would create a pilot program through Department of Education to 10 organizations around the country to try and build this. Is it based on anything? Is there a model here that has worked?
We pilot projects in 10 states. Those states would be able to be flexible in how they organize their apprenticeship programs. If you want to look at models, how this would work, we can look at other westernized industrialized countries, Germany and Switzerland, for example. I think the number is 70 to 75% of all students who go to higher education in Switzerland, as an example, go to a two-year program and into internships. But good-paying jobs are going wanting right now. Over 25,000 jobs in Washington State today in STEM and science, technology, engineering, math are going wanting because we don't currently have the pipeline of kids to fill those roles.
So, in addition to this act, you've also been pretty active this session in supporting voter rights bills, including the 2017 America Votes Act, mm-hmm. which would make it easier for people living in states with voter ID requirements. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Very serious about, and a lot of us in Congress are serious about voting rights. One thing, you know, obviously very concerned about now is the president's so-called Voter Integrity Commission, which comes across like a commission designed only to purge voter rolls or find ways to make it more difficult to vote. And voter ID laws in country, I think, are designed to make voting more difficult. They're actually voter suppression laws, in my view. What the America Votes Act does, my bill does, is to say, if you're in a state with a voter ID law and you show up to vote and you don't have the correct voter ID, you get to vote your ballot, not as a provisional ballot, but as a counted ballot, and then you have to go back and show your appropriate ID. Right now, in a lot of states, you either with voter ID, you don't get to vote at all, or you have to vote a provisional ballot. I think this will work because one, Washington State, we have a so-called voter ID law, and in that, only in that, when you register to vote, you have to show ID. Only when you register, but when you vote, you don't have to because we vote at home. We vote by mail, and the only person available to check your ID really is you, yourself. You have to sign an affidavit on the ballot that says you are who you are, and under penalty of prison time and fines, you vote your ballot. And if you're shown to be a fraud, you'll be in prison or you'll be fined. Higher penalties for voter fraud, I'm all for. I'm for lower barriers for actual voting. If you're registered to vote, if you're eligible to vote and registered to vote, that should be all you need to vote, in my view.
So it kind of feels like an undercurrent of this century so far has been this kind of low-level conflict over voter rights. And it feels like it's been going on for a long time. And I don't want to discount the work of, like, Reverend Barber in the Southeast, but it doesn't feel like it's captured the imagination of people. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. And, yeah, Reverend Barber, I think, in North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken, and many others around the country have really pushed back on both voter ID laws as well as changes to dates and time frames and where people can vote in order to expand the franchise and expand the ability to vote. I'm not quite sure why we haven't been able to capture people's imagination a little bit more, although that doesn't mean we're going to give up. I think that it's more insidious than I think the requirements and the limitations put on voting is more insidious than it has been in the past. You know, in the 60s and before, it was largely, you know, if you were an African American or if people didn't, you know, like you otherwise, there were a lot of simple ways that the people who ran elections could stop you from voting. And some of those just were so egregiously evil that it just became really kind of crystal clear for folks that the laws needed to change. It's a little tougher to argue against. Well, you know, in the past we didn't vote. We didn't allow people to vote early on a Sunday or a week ahead of time. So why should we be forced to allow people to vote a week ahead of time now? Well, that's a good argument, except that if you had that law in place and then you took it away, there's really only one reason you'd take it away, and that's to prevent people from voting. I think we just need to continue to lay out in practical terms what these hurdles to voting means to our democracy, and talk about it in terms of fairness for everybody.
So here in Washington, we have universal vote by mail. Oregon now has automatic voter registration. Do you support those nationally? Do you think that model could work nationally?
I'm a co-sponsor of a bill to have motor voter and automatic registration. Vote by mail, I think it works. It works for us. It works for Oregon. I think that's probably going to have to go state by state. I don't know that we should mandate that nationally, I don't think we need to mandate it nationally. But I do think that only because it's not addressing a barrier to voting. People can still vote even in a non-vote by mail state. What we have an obligation to do in Congress and therefore nationally is to ensure that the barriers to voting for those who are eligible to vote and register to vote are as low as possible.
however states decide how they want to conduct their elections, the barriers to voting should be as low as possible. And I think that's where the sweet spot is for Congress.
All right. Well, the big headline thing now for most of this year and probably for weeks to come is the fight over healthcare and the attempts by Republican leadership in the House and Senate to change it dramatically to fund a massive tax cut. How has that been going?
Well, you've described it accurately. There is a explicit connection between repealing the Affordable Care Act and the taxes that help fund it to the efforts by the Republican majority to finance, pay for a massive tax cut that would largely benefit the richest Americans. There's just no other way to describe why they're doing what they're doing. The fight to stop Trump care, has gone pretty well. Has gone pretty well. In the House, we did not succeed in stopping it, but we did succeed, and I think a lot of folks need to take credit for this. A lot of citizens need to take credit for this. We did succeed in raising the political hurdles that the Republicans had to jump over to pass their version of Trump care. It is extremely clear that the House version of Trump care would knock 24 million people off of health insurance. It will increase premiums. A recent analysis of the Senate, of one of the Senate versions of Trump care, shows that by 2026, premiums will increase 100% for people, 25% by 2018, 50% by 2022, and 100%. So what Trump care means is fewer people will be insured, your neighbors will no longer have health care insurance, your premiums and your neighbors' premiums will increase astronomically. That is what the Republican health care package means. And we just need to continue to fight to stop that. And again, raise the political hurdle, because as they say about members of Congress, we don't see the light until we feel the heat. And people need to continue to feel the heat on their efforts to strip away health care from their neighbors.
So it feels like we're in this kind of loop. There was a version of the health care changes in the House that failed, and then there was a version that succeeded. There's been, at the time of this recording, I think two versions in the Senate that have not succeeded. And it kind of feels like they're gearing up to try again with what is basically the same thing. Are they just going to keep pushing this over and over again until it gets through?
I don't know what the Senate majority leader's plan is, whether it's an attempt to continue to vote to try to bring up their version of Trump care until they get the 51 votes to do that. The problem that Senate Republicans have is that so far every plan they've put up means more people uninsured. It means health care will cost more for people. As one senator who is so far, as of this recording, as she has held out and has refused to vote to proceed on this debate, she said that she wasn't sent to Congress, she wasn't sent to the Senate to be mean to the people she represents. And this is a Republican. So I think that the folks who are holding out really do kind of see it that way, that you're knocking millions of people off of health insurance, happens to be Medicaid. I think the Republicans thought that because they were cutting Medicaid, that most people would say, that's just health care for the poor, and therefore we don't have to care about it. As it turns out, quite a number of middle-class folks depend upon Medicaid. Medicaid is nationally pays for about 50% of nursing home care. So you have a lot of moms and dads whose moms and dads are in nursing homes around the country, and maybe they depend on Medicaid. Medicaid pays for a substantial amount of treatment and recovery services for what is clearly a nationwide opioid epidemic. and you want to cut Medicaid, you're going to cut treatment and recovery services for moms and dads who are maybe depend upon Medicaid to help their son or daughter through this addiction of opioids. So it's not just – Medicaid is not just health care for the poor. It's health care for the middle class. It provides a safety net for a lot of our neighbors, a lot of your neighbors, and a lot of neighbors of Senate Republicans.
So we've talked about some of the big headline issues, and it feels like a lot of the national attention is on the antics of the president and his, you know, alleged connections with foreign governments. What's happened?
Just one in particular, Russia.
So far. What's happening in Congress that you think people here in the 2nd District should be paying more attention to?
You know, yeah, that's a great question, because I think that some of the actions, some of the activities that Congress is taking to address this issue in Russia haven't been in the news lately, because so much attention has been on what the president's been doing. But the Senate and the House intelligence committees continue their investigations into the alleged, in all fairness, I've got to say alleged connections that the president has to Russia, specifically to Russian interference in our election in 2016. That's a big deal. The president has tried to make this argument that this is really about did Russia influence the outcome to result in his win. I don't even go that far. I think it's bad enough that the Russians interfered in our election, and I care about our democracy and our democratic republic enough to care about that. The president could do himself a favor first by recognizing the concern that many Americans have, and that is just the fact that Russia attempted to or did interfere, according to our intelligence communities, did interfere in our elections, and there ought to be something done about that. But he won't do that. But as anything, they even said this about this came up this term came up during Watergate. The cover-up's always worse than the crime. There's not even an allegation really of a crime in formal circles. I have a lot of people write into my office saying the president's committed a crime. But in formal circles and the folks who actually make these determinations, there's been no determination. There's been a crime committed. However, the actions the president has taken sure makes it smell like something wrong happened. That is, the cover-up, the actions he's taking, seem to show that he's got something to hide. And he needs to come clean. My limited understanding of this president is that he is not one to give up a fight. He is one to pick a fight. He is not one to show humility so far. And I think he just may be unable to come clean with whatever he has to come clean with. But the flip side is Congress isn't going to stop looking. The special counsel, which I support, and I support special counsel Mueller, I do not support the president firing him. There's been some discussion about whether the president would fire him. I do not support that. The special counsel needs to have the independence and freedom to do his job, and it may lead to nothing, and it may lead to something. But that's what investigations are for. And once an investigation is completed, then Congress can make determinations about what it ought to do, and the special counsel can make determinations about what his recommendations would be as a result of that investigation.
You talked about the opioid crisis. This is not, you know, our first in recent memory drug crisis. We had the methamphetamine crisis as well, which, you know, hit Snohomish County like a bomb. I remember that well, and Skagit and Whatcom. What could be done at the congressional level to address that better?
Well, last year, in the President Obama's last term, last year of his term, we passed the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act. Then we funded it as well. So what that bill did is several things. One, in an immediate sense, it helped fund the availability of Narcan and naloxone for local law enforcement agencies. This is the drug that is the opioid overdose reversal drug. So it saves lives. It doesn't, though, stave off addiction, but it does save lives. But the second thing this bill did is fund four states grants that help them develop, further develop treatment plans, treatment centers, and recovery centers. I've talked to local parents about their experiences with opioid addiction because their child, son or daughter, is a victim of this crisis. And they're really clear that treatment is important, but recovery is equally important. Treatment doesn't get you recovered. Recovery gets you recovered. And so the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act, or CARA, helps fund treatment and recovery plans as well. So now we need to continue funding it. And we're not off to a great start with this president. He's gutting the Office of National Drug Control Policy, which does a lot of public education around drug addiction. And he has proposed cuts to mental health and substance abuse services. I think Congress will eventually reject those cuts, much like we're rejecting a lot of his proposed cuts that he has proposed so he can give tax cuts to the richest Americans and increase the defense budget beyond our means. We have some work to do in Congress, Democrats and Republicans, to push back on him. So there are some things we can do. The structure's in place. We put it in place with this law. We now need to continue to fund it and fight off the president's proposed budget cuts to that funding.
So you're not just the representative of the 2nd District. You're a resident of the 2nd District. And as a Washingtonian, you know, at the time of this recording, our legislature just banged the gavel closed, ended their session without passing a capital budget. Have you been following that? Are you?
Not particularly. I was born and raised in Arlington, Washington. You know, I'm very fortunate to be able to represent a district that I was born and raised in, and have family in the Whatcom area. My family settled in the out near Deming in the late 1800s. The church that sits at the corner there of Lawrence Road and Mount Baker Highway, my great-grandparents built it. They're buried in the cemetery there. I got roots up here. So I do follow what goes on up here. I follow what goes on in the district and follow what goes on in the state. And as a citizen and a taxpayer, I have a real concern about what the legislature does. My main concern is that they did something with McCleary, the education fix, as well as transportation funding, because I'm on the Transportation Committee in Congress, the only member from Washington State on the Transportation Committee. And, you know, building, repairing, and maintaining our roads, our bridges, our highways, and our transit systems is critical for our economy and critical for creating jobs and having better jobs here in the Pacific Northwest. But I follow tangentially most other issues in the legislature. And I think if you talk to legislators, they probably say the same about Congress. They've got their business to do, and I've got my business to do. So I know the capital budget's got a hiccup related to something, but I couldn't quite go into any detail on what that is. But I can give you a lot of detail about a lot of other things in Congress.
Fair enough. So, you know, we talked about some of the clownery in the administration and
buffoonery is a better term.
There you go. Yeah. And some of the missteps of the leadership in the House and the Senate. But what we haven't seen, at least in a national polling way, is that people are clearly saying we're not happy with the president. We're really not happy with what Congress is doing. But it hasn't turned into an advantage for Democrats yet.
Right. Yeah. So like, what about you, Democrats? Right. Yeah. The there was recently a string of tweets about what the Democratic theme was in 2006 when we got the majority when Bush was president. And a lot of people there was actually a theme we used in 2006. But people were tweeting things like, we're not George Bush, or, you know, just things like we weren't the other guy. And I think, you know, it's middle of 2017. I know a lot of folks are focused on 2018, the election. Frankly, it's a little early to be focused on the election 2018, in my view. As somebody who is going to be running in that election, I can tell you that 2 years ago and 4 years ago and 6 years ago, you know, at these same times, I wasn't focused on the next election then either, and yet won. So I think that it could be a little early. But I do – and when I talk to local Democrats, I do say this, that at some point the Democrats need to flip the switch from being anti-Trump to being pro-Democratic. And there isn't a date when that has to happen, but it does have to happen. But looking forward, I do think that there are some lessons from the 2016 election, and there's some things to think about going forward in terms of what Democrats are for. And then people can make some choices. I'll go through just a couple of those. But another way to think about it, as I tell Democrats, like President Trump will deliver 49% of the vote to the Democrats. What are we going to do to deliver the next 2%? And what are you going to do to get the majority? Because voters want to vote for something, not against something. That is not lost on the Democratic Party at all. The Republicans are going to have to own the top of their ticket, just like Democrats had to own the top of the ticket when Obama was there. And Republicans will have to own the top of their ticket. So we don't have to do much about Trump. We have to do a lot more about Democrats. So I think first and foremost, I think about my experience in winning, and I got 64.5% in 2016, the highest percentage I've ever got. And I look back on other elections I've won and when I've run and won in 2010, where I barely won, but I still won. If Democrats don't get back to talking about jobs, and the way I talk about it is in infrastructure, building roads, bridges, and highways, that puts people to work, not doing the things that are nice to do, but doing things that we need to do, we need to have done to help our economy. The reason I talk about the Youth Access to American Jobs Act is because the next thing we need to be thinking about is recognizing that people are still concerned about the economy. They're concerned about global trends that impact the ability to create jobs in the United States. And how do we stay competitive? How do we ensure our kids are ready for that? And that's why it's important that we have a commitment to training that next generation workforce, that there's a commitment, a covenant between the Democrats and the voting public and those who don't vote, that we understand that anxiety that moms and dads have about what the future is for their kids. And finally, I would say that for Democrats, we need to talk about inclusion. I think we got a little wrapped around the axle about inclusion, meaning inclusion for only some people in 2016. Inclusion means everybody. The Republicans, from a national party perspective, and I know a lot of good Republicans, and they're my friends, and they would agree with me that their party is not seen as a party that wants everybody to be included. They talk about opportunity, but they want to help anybody get to that opportunity. We need, as Democrats, to talk about how we're going to help everybody, whether they look like me or not, whether they vote like me or not. We have to be in a position to say we want everybody to have that opportunity and build the country that gives everybody that opportunity. So, you know, we have to offer something that shows concern for today, jobs, a concern for tomorrow, what's the future look like for your children, as well as something that's aspirational, a country where everybody actually does get to be included in the opportunity to benefit from what the country has to offer. I think we can structure messages around that. That's what I've tried to do in running for office in the past, and we'll do so in the future as well. And that's the message I'll take to my leadership.
And our most demanded question has been about Amtrak funding, and there's been a lot of threats to their long-haul routes. And here in the Northwest, you know, Amtrak is probably my favorite way of traveling. And what's the state of that?
Well, Washington State itself has invested well over $100 million over time into both operating Amtrak in a partnership with Amtrak, as well as into the rail system that supports Amtrak. So it's something that I've followed quite closely in my 17 years in Congress. I think that this administration, much like it has approached all infrastructure spending, is pretty lackadaisical and fairly circumspect in their support for Amtrak. They see everything as strictly a zero-sum game, and as well as if you're not making a profit on anything, then you're going to shut it down. Well, it's not exactly how transportation systems work. So I'm very empathetic, sympathetic with folks who want to continue the Amtrak funding. I support that. I'll continue to support it. We'll see what we can do to, again, fight off or stave off any proposed cuts the president has for Amtrak.
Thank you for joining us, Representative Larson.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.